Hi and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Michelle Rayner. Today, shutting down Charlene. It's a story with everything. HIV/AIDS, sex workers, nuns, guns, heroin, politicians and primetime television. The year is 1989. Charlene Spiteri is a sex worker, a drug user and she's HIV positive. In other words, she's a walking invitation to moral panic. Charlene tells her story to a national TV current affairs program. The outcome of this sees her locked up in an AIDS ward. And she'll spend much of her life thereafter in suburban detention under 24-hour supervision. But Charlene Spiteri will also change laws and attitudes to AIDS around the country. In today's feature, which investigates the events that took place 20 years ago, the key players in Charlene's story speak frankly for the first time. And a warning, this program contains sex scenes, drug references and strong language. Shutting Down Charlene is produced by Tom Morton and Eurydice Aroney.
I'm standing on the corner of Forbes and Liverpool Street in Darlinghurst, just down from King's Cross. If I'd walked along here in 1989, I would have run the gauntlet of up to 50 women working along these couple of blocks. Charlene Spiteri would have been one of them. She used to work right here on this corner. Charlene ran away from home at 15, lived in refuges and squats, got herself a criminal record and a drug habit. At the time our story starts, Charlene's 25. She's not living the good life. 3 years ago, she tested positive for HIV. She got the virus from a dirty needle. And for someone so tough, she's mighty scared. Since she was diagnosed, over 500 people have died from AIDS in New South Wales. Most of them lived around here. It's a familiar enough story on these streets. But then, one night in July 1989... everything changes. Charlene will move from the edges of society to public enemy number one.
Do you tell them that you've got AIDS?
I don't tell them, no, but I make them wear condoms. I mean, it's something because I don't think I'd... if I told them that, I'd probably get killed or something. You know, that's what I'm worried about.
Speaking to 60 Minutes reporter Jeff McMullen, Charlene, the leading lady in a story about AIDS and prostitution, and she's battling to make her clients wear condoms. But sometimes they just won't play by the rules.
I've caught men sort of trying to take it off, sort of, when they're halfway there, you know, trying to be shifty and all that.
We see Charlene wandering the streets at night, as skinny as an alley cat. Her Jackie O-style sunglasses are poor disguise. 60 Minutes have arranged a blonde Marilyn Monroe-style wig. She'd like that. She was a big fan of Marilyn's. But in the 60 Minutes story, they call her by a little girl's name, Marianne.
Marianne says she's been sleeping with at least 10 men a week. It means if only half of them are wearing condoms, at least 1,000 men, not to mention their wives and girlfriends, are at risk of getting the AIDS virus. No matter how much we feel sorry for Marianne, she's more dangerous than a serial killer.
The next day, serial killer Charlene is front page news.
This is the AIDS-infected prostitute at the centre of the controversy. Her frank admission.
She told the Nine Network that sex acts took place without the use of condoms.
This woman is a lethal weapon, declares the Sydney Daily Telegraph. If a restaurant persisted in serving poisoned food, it would be shut down. This woman is a public business and must be treated accordingly. And that's exactly what the New South Wales government did. Shut down Charlene.
I'm going through a bit of a hell and trouble here because they won't let me go out. They won't let me go for a walk. I'm getting trapped in here, actually. It's like a prison.
Charlene hadn't committed a crime. She hadn't broken the law. But the New South Wales government used an obscure section of the Public Health Act to take her from her home under police guard and lock her up in a closed AIDS ward and then a mental hospital. Dr. Sue Morey was chief health officer at the time. She signed the order which put Charlene away.
I don't believe we had any other alternative at that point in time. And I think there was a community expectation that people like that were not safe to be on the street, that there was a risk to public health.
The government's hard line brought a hostile reaction from civil liberty groups, with the AIDS Council warning that detention could set a dangerous precedent.
If, for instance, we were regularly locking people away, you would find we would lose control of the epidemic. The very people we're trying to reach and gain cooperation would not give that cooperation.
I mean, detention is an attractive, simple option, but, you know, it is a lifetime infection. You're going to lock them up till the day they die, or do you release them a month later and produce a highly alienated, hostile, disoriented person who is possibly even less in control of their behaviour? Detention is an extremely expensive option. It's potentially an extreme human rights abuse.
Basil Donovan, pioneering AIDS physician and chair of the so-called Very Naughty Persons Committee, set up to manage very naughty people like Charlene. Charlene's forcible detention provoked intense controversy at the time, and the public were horrified by Charlene's frank admission. The papers were full of letters calling for prostitutes with HIV to be locked up or shipped off to remote islands. But was there any evidence that Charlene or other sex workers were infecting their clients with HIV?
None whatsoever. There'd been a lot of rumour, a lot of people making that sort of claim, but here we are more than 20 years later and there is not a single documented case of HIV transmission from a sex worker to a client in Australia's history.
Charlene was released from the lockup after a few weeks, but as you'll hear, she spent most of the next 16 years in suburban detention, living in a Housing Commission flat under 24-hour supervision by health workers, in a twilight zone, neither a prisoner nor a free woman.
She was still a human being, but somewhere got lost along the way. You know, she was the state's dirty little secret, and she disappeared below the radar.
That's Dennis, who got to know Charlene towards the end of her life when she was under house arrest. She died, still under a public health order, in 2005. So who was Charlene and why her? Why, in a country with one of the most progressive AIDS policies in the world, did Charlene have to be locked up and then spend the rest of her life under surveillance? Charlene's story is full of secrets. Secrets kept by the health department in the name of patient confidentiality. Secrets kept by other sex workers. It seems the only one who couldn't keep a secret was Charlene. We might never have heard of Charlene in the first place if she hadn't told her secrets to a journalist called Ron Hicks. Back in 1989, Hicks set out to write a story about the second wave of AIDS, the possibility it would cross over into the heterosexual population.
The main target at that time, we were looking at the intravenous drug community, and that was what I was looking at. I wasn't looking for a prostitute with AIDS. So I went to a doctor in King's Cross, and he put me on to somebody in the community health field, and they in turn put me on to Charlene, and that just blew my mind.
Well, what were your first impressions of Charlene when you met her?
Oh, I was always very sorry. She was a victim right from the start. Once she started telling me her story, you couldn't help but feel such sorrow for her life. She was pretty clear, I don't know when she told me, but fairly on that she'd been sexually abused as a child. And then she drifted onto the streets. And when she drifted on the street, you knew her life was sort of doomed.
Big veins, the babe. Yeah, they really want you.
Courtney Love, rich kid, grunge queen. Charlene, Courtney Love without the trust fund. Char's 14 when her mum takes off with four of the eight children. Charlene, the eldest, is left with her father in Strathfield, but not for long. A year later, she's off. Doesn't finish year 10. Gravitates to the cross. Falls in love. According to her probation report, her intermittent boyfriend is a constant cause of concern. In other words, he's violent and has a heroin habit. He's also the father of her young son. She's got few friends except those she's made on the street.
I'm Sam, and I've known Charlene since she was about 17, when she first came up to the cross.
Can you remember the time you met Charlene? Can you tell us that story?
The very moment. True. Well, I was walking across Victoria Street, King's Cross, and I just said hello to her because she was a young girl just starting out. The first words were to me were, "Where can I work?" Well, we used to work on the same corner, Liverpool and Forbes or Liverpool and Darley, and you keep an eye on each other, and if we were both and one of us was hanging out, we used to share our drugs and our money and even share our accommodation when we lived in squats and all that.
I met Charlene when I was the in-house manager of the Australian Prostitutes Collective. So she would drop by and have coffee and cups of tea and talk to people and hang out with others in the drop-in room.
Julie Bates. It was Julie who introduced Charlene to medical writer Ron Hicks.
He came to her house where Charlene had a shrine set up to her son that he one day was going to come home. And there was his little cot and his teddy bears and pictures on the walls. And yeah, and he reported this story, which was quite a positive story, on the plight of a young woman living with AIDS.
Ron Hicks's profile of Charlene was published in the Australian magazine. Hicks stayed in touch with Char, and one day, over a cup of coffee, she made a startling revelation.
She revealed to me that people paid her more money to have sex without a condom. And I think she told me in the magazine that she wouldn't have sex with anyone without a condom, you know. I just thought this was a major story that the public should know about.
So you say that when you interviewed her for the article in the Australian magazine that she had stressed to you that she made her clients use condoms, but after that she said to you that in fact she would have sex with clients without condoms if they paid her more money.
That's right. Of course, she was a drug addict, and so she took it. So this opens Pandora's box. I mean, how many people did she have sex with without any protection? How many people potentially may have been affected?
At first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it.
Well, in the late 1980s, HIV and AIDS had been around for less than 10 years. There was still a tremendous amount of worldwide fear about HIV. The public were not clear about how it was transmitted. There were concerns that it was transmitted by shaking hands, by toilet seats, by going to hairdressers, kissing.
Professor Julian Gold, director of the Albion Street Clinic in Sydney, which takes care of 2,000 people living with HIV. He's been working in AIDS medicine for more than 25 years, and Charlene was one of his patients.
People with HIV and their community groups were very concerned about the potential for stigma and discrimination and even the potential for isolation. Some people were talking about moving people with HIV into separate colonies. And in Cuba, for instance, they took people with HIV, isolated them on islands with barbed wire, and some countries followed that line.
I'm here on the corner where Charlene used to work, and I'm here with Roberta Perkins. Roberta is Australia's foremost researcher on prostitution, with a string of books to her name. So what was it like when HIV hit? Were the workers all talking about it?
The workers were certainly all talking about it, and when they would see us, they'd want to know more, and we would take people from the clinics around as well. What about condom use at that time, Roberta?
Look, now, the condom's an interesting thing, you know. Look, as far as I was concerned, everybody wore condoms, and that the rule here, if you didn't, and I know this actually happened, if you even thought not to wear condoms, and quite sometimes girls would be really nasty with another. She'd say, she's seen too many clients, she must be giving it to them without a condom. And I know one girl had all her hair cut off and beaten up because they assumed, they didn't know, they assumed she didn't wear a condom. That had been a rule for a long, long time.
Charlene was never one to play by the rules. After she told Ron Hicks she would have unprotected sex with clients, Hicks decided to take the story to 60 Minutes.
I thought that was really the audience that this story was aimed for, really.
How did Charlene feel about doing it?
Yeah, Charlene, she was a strange person. She's a very honest person. Her only main condition was that she wanted to try and get to see her family, and she thought that that would happen through 60 Minutes, and it did.
Charlene agreed to be interviewed on camera on condition that 60 Minutes fly her down to Adelaide to see her four-year-old son, who was now living with her mother.
She trusted me, so she wanted me to go everywhere with her. We went to Adelaide and we met the mother, and it was very difficult, very, very, very difficult.
How are you, all right?
Okay.
That's good. David, come here, David. Come to Mummy. Come to Mummy. Can you give Mummy a hug?
It was a very bitter meeting. The mother still almost seemed to hate Charlene and really didn't want to give Charlene access to her own son.
What happened when you used to take him out for a day, kidnap him, never bring him back for days?
I think you're bullshitting there, love.
No.
You are, Mum.
I'd just say lock her up for 10 years in a mental home or something, anywhere. Just as long as the strong bars, just keep her out of the community, away from everybody.
In 10 years, she could be dead.
That's right. We'll lock her up.
That evening in the hotel down there, I remember, she got quite morose. And as the night progressed, it just got louder and louder next door. And, you know, she just, every mini bottle in the bar, everything she could drink and get her hands on, she did. And she just got worse and worse, to the point that I got a call from a 60 Minutes producer in Sydney to do something about Charlene in Adelaide.
When she returned from Adelaide, 60 Minutes gave Charlene the red carpet treatment. They put her up in a motel, paid her medical bills. Reporter Jeff McMullen taped a face-to-face interview with Charlene, where she talked frankly about her life as a sex worker. In this story too, Charlene went by the pseudonym Marianne.
You're about to meet Marianne, a woman who almost certainly risked her life talking to us. You'll understand why when you hear her story. It's about drugs, AIDS, and the world's oldest profession, a lethal combination which could eventually threaten all of us.
I remember getting a call on the Sunday night, and she watched the program and she went berserk again. She just started drinking everything in the minibar again and doing Charlene.
She was upset?
She gets very upset and very loud.
What was she upset about?
You know, it's like you don't know what this interview is going to come out like. So you've got one perception of an interview and somebody else has another perception, and the truth lies in between.
What do they call you now that you've got AIDS?
They call me a germ. We should bring the pest control van to spray you.
Just to focus for a moment on that night when she saw the story, I mean, there is a moment in that story where the reporter Jeff McMullen says she's potentially worse than a serial killer.
Yes, well, the interview was pretty brutal. It had to be, I think, to get to the truth of the matter. And, yes, it would have been very difficult for Charlene, very difficult for Charlene. But she knew what she was getting in for.
So the story goes to air.
Yeah,
what happened?
The story goes to air and all hell breaks loose.
We were forced to act in a case which was confronting and unique at that stage.
New South Wales Health Minister at the time, Peter Collins.
There hadn't been a previous case of a sex worker coming out saying, I've got AIDS and I'm not going to stop working and I'm not going to take any protective measures.
So when you say you were forced to act, what was forcing you to act?
When something runs on a major public affairs program like 60 Minutes or Four Corners, Today Tonight, there is no escaping it. That goes to the top of the agenda. You've got to find a solution. So you can have a press conference on anything you like, but the question will come back to as soon as you finish speaking. So, Mr. Collins, what are you going to do in the case of Charlene Spiteri, who was on 60 Minutes saying that she's having unprotected sex as a prostitute? What are you going to do to protect the community?
The New South Wales Health Minister, Peter Collins, felt he had no choice but to do something about Charlene. The question was what? Behind closed doors in the New South Wales Health Department, there was heated discussion between the Minister and his advisers, one of whom was Professor John Dwyer.
Peter Collins. Peter was extremely agitated by the whole situation, and he was quite open about saying that he felt he had to be seen to be being tough here and be firm here and protecting the community.
Eventually, a health department bureaucrat hit on a solution, one which appealed to Peter Collins.
There was a little used section of the Public Health Act, that is section 32A, and it allows the detention of someone with an infectious disease.
In the past, Section 32A of the Public Health Act had been used to isolate patients with tuberculosis.
At the time, it was the one legislative handle they could grab hold of to pull themselves out of the mess that they were in at that time, as they saw it.
So, in your view then, forcibly detaining Charlene was not the right action?
No, because it was, at best, could have been a very short-term solution to an immediate political problem. It just relieved the heat from the government of the day by having her out of harm's way, out of circulation for a while.
John Dwyer had spent 15 years at Yale University and seen the outbreak of AIDS in the United States firsthand before returning to Australia to head up the AIDS unit at Prince Henry Hospital. He told Peter Collins that locking Charlene up might be good politics, but it was bad policy. But Dwyer lost the argument, and he now got the job of bringing Charlene in.
And I remember getting a call to say that the Department of Health wished me to go with one of their senior officers and the police out to Charlene's place, I think it was about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and get her and take her out to Prince Henry, which we duly did. The suggestion that Mr. Collins made later on that this was all very voluntary on her part and that she was quite willing to go into this protective custody at Prince Henry is not accurate. She was very angry and very emotional and was quite difficult. Blocked doors and Charlene screaming and kicking and the like. It was really a horrible situation.
Charlene was locked up in Prince Henry Hospital and under constant supervision. But that wasn't going to stop Channel 9 and Channel 10 running further with the story.
You know, a number of others then came on the bandwagon, even one team arriving by helicopter at the old Prince Henry Hospital to interview her. She managed to escape and go out into the yard and do the interview, more money, as the security arrived and the helicopter took off.
I'm going through a bit of a hell and trouble here because they won't let me go out. They won't let me go for a walk. I'm getting trapped in here, actually. It's like a prison.
If anything, locking Charlene up had only made her more of a celebrity. The government needed to get Charlene out of the media spotlight. Julie Bates wanted to get Charlene out of detention. Julie had a brainwave that might please both. Where better to hide Charlene than in a nunnery?
It was in the papers, of course, that Charlene had taken refuge in a convent, and the media were running around camping outside convents, but they never thought that a little terrace house in King's Cross was actually a convent, so they never ever bothered camping outside our door.
Sister Nolene, a woman with a habit, but not the kind of habit you'd usually associate with King's Cross. Sister Nolene is a nun, a brown sister. She'd been working with drug users and sex workers around King's Cross for some years, and she got to know Julie Bates. Sister Nolene got a call from Julie. Would the nuns give refuge to Charlene? No problem. Sister Nolene went down to Charlene's room soon after she'd arrived.
I found her cleaning the toilet and a very strong smell of bleach. And here she was scrubbing away And it's a moment which I never have forgotten, really, in my life. And she said, "Now, this is my bathroom, isn't it? You won't use this, will you? Please don't use this because, you know, I wouldn't want anything to happen to you. I wouldn't want to hurt you." And I was struck by the decimation of self-esteem in the person. And in that moment, it struck me that Charlene viewed herself as nothing more than a germ.
Charlene spent a few days holed up in the convent. The media buzz died down. Julie Bates negotiated a deal with the health department. She would keep a watchful eye on Charlene, and Charlene could have her life back.
I said, "OK, Charlene, you're a free woman for a bit. We're going to stay at the CB Hotel where no one will notice you there."
Another mistake.
"No one will notice you there, Charlene." And she said, "Oh, good, I've got boots on lay-by in the Queen Victoria building." And I said, "Beauty, we'll go shopping, but you've got to be really well-behaved. There'll be no kind of drawing attention to yourself." And we get into the Queen Victoria building, we go to the shoe shop, goes, and she says, "I've got boots on lay-by here. My name's Charlene. I'm famous, you know me. I was on 60 Minutes. And they're all going, "Oh." So she has all her money down her bra and her knickers, and she's pulling out rolls of money and pays for her boots. And they're gorgeous, but she's a bag girl, you know. She's got bags of stuff everywhere and probably a few pills in her bags too. And so I said, "OK, well, why don't we go and have a little lunch upstairs in that open coffee shop bit, you know?" And I go in to order and she's nodded off and she's almost got her head stuck through the railing. And we come back to the CB and there's the black screen, you know, limousine windows waiting outside the CB.
What was that all about?
The health department and their hench people to take Charlie and I to a secret location south of Sydney.
That secret location was a disused nurse's home next to Garrawarra Geriatric Hospital. Dr. Sue Morey was chief health officer in New South Wales at the time, and she signed the public health orders which detained Charlene at Prince Henry Hospital, Roselle Mental Hospital and at Garrawarra.
I visited Charlene in Garrawarra, and as I said, she was not a well lady, and I'm not really sure how responsible she was for any of her actions at that point in time. We wanted her to have the opportunity to recover from some of the current problems that she had in a situation where she was away from the media, and whether both Charlene and the staff would be safer, because there were threats to her safety. There were some violent scenes, and we didn't think that was in anyone's best interest.
Sue Morey left the New South Wales Health Department in the mid-90s and is now a private consultant. But 20 years on, she still believes the decision to incarcerate Charlene was the right one for the public and for Charlene.
I don't believe we had any other alternative at that point in time.
Why not?
Well, I think the clinicians who had been caring for her for the past year had tried all sorts of counselling, moving her between different clinicians, different clinics, trying to get her to change her behaviour. And I think there was a community expectation that people like that were not safe to be on the street, that there was a risk to public health.
In actual fact, at that time, there had been a study published showing that something like 87% of the prostitutes going to Kirkton Road Clinic were in fact using condoms, which was up from 5% 5 or 6 years before. So the self-help approach that we were taking by working with that community rather than against them, by involving them in their own care, had clearly worked.
So, in other words, Charlene's situation had been well known to the medical authorities, if you like, to the Kirkton Road Clinic, to the other agencies that were involved in her care and counselling, but it was only the 60 Minutes story, only the fact that she went on national television, that actually then resulted in action being taken to forcibly detain
Correct.
Her.
Not only had the health authorities known all about Charlene, they knew there were other sex workers like her who were HIV positive and still doing sex work. Ingrid van Beek is the director of the Kirkton Road Centre in the heart of King's Cross. Services like Kirkton Road played a frontline role in the fight against AIDS. Ingrid first met Charlene in 1987 when she became a client of the centre. Was she the first HIV positive sex worker to come to Kirkton Road?
No, there were quite a substantial number of people involved in sex work at that stage who were tested positive in those very early years.
Health authorities took a calculated risk. Work with the groups who were most vulnerable to HIV, the gay community, drug users and sex workers, rather than isolating them. It was a risky strategy that required political courage.
I mean, as the opposition spokesman on health in the run-up to the 88 state election, I had attacked the needle and syringe exchange program. I'll reveal the person who changed my mind. It was Professor Ron Penny at St Vincent's Hospital, who said, if you don't change your mind, people are going to die. He persuaded me, and I did a 180 degrees, and we continued the needle and syringe exchange program.
Former New South Wales Health Minister Peter Collins. Australia's handling of the epidemic saved thousands of lives and is now recognised internationally as the gold standard in AIDS policy. But when Charlene went on 60 Minutes, she set off a wave of moral panic which could have blown this progressive policy out of the water.
You know, for the whole of the HIV program to continue to be able to operate required the community to be generally and broadly supportive. You know, from a public health point of view, you know, we would like, of course, to say it should be a buyer beware situation and the responsibility should lie with the customers. So, yes, I don't think that it would have been acceptable at the community level for us to say, look, you know, maybe there's a handful of HIV-positive sex workers out there, but hey, the risk is still very low.
But some sex workers, like Julie Bates, saw the government approach as outright discrimination.
Here we have the virus spreading, you know, quite substantially in the gay world in Sydney, but nobody is being detained here. The law is not being used to lock any gay boys away at this stage. We've got this one poor little frightened girl who's typhoid fucking Mary, who really needed some social work and some sort of decent caring and looking after her mental health at the time, but she suddenly becomes the whipping girl of HIV in this country.
In the year following her appearance on 60 Minutes, Charlene had some of the most experienced AIDS physicians in the country looking after her, three different clinics monitoring her, and the head of the New South Wales AIDS Bureau personally managing her case. Charlene would now become the most expensive public patient in the history of New South Wales health. Professor Julian Gold.
You know, one of the responses of the government, understandably, was, well, if Charlene can't be trusted not to spread HIV, then it would be necessary to have somebody with her at all times, accompanying her. And New South Wales Health assigned a team of healthcare workers to be with her 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And I remember when the department arranged for her to get an apartment, going out frequently in the first few weeks to the apartment, and people were buying her food, bringing her methadone.
I set up this community care round the clock. The community actually became a jail. It's when I look back on it now.
'90s, it was so far so good. Charlene was stable and keeping on the straight and narrow, or as straight and narrow as she could. But her case sent ripples through the legal system around the country.
Now the federal government has weighed into the Charlene affair. The federal health minister, Dr. Neil Blewett, says that the case of what happens to someone who spreads AIDS knowingly will be addressed in the government's draft policy paper on AIDS, due to be released soon.
The New South Wales Parliament also passed a new law, which was quickly named Charlene's Law.
There was a new bill that was introduced where you had to seek the informed consent of your partners to have sexual intercourse, whether you be a sex worker or a private individual. So you had to go and tell everybody, hello, I've got AIDS, do you mind?
Instead of kiss and tell, it was tell then kiss. It's perhaps the only law in Australian history named after a sex worker. A panel, known colloquially as the Naughty Persons Committee, was set up to supervise Charlene in cases like hers. But Charlene kept on finding new ways to be naughty.
Her boyfriend was out of jail shortly afterwards.
She loved him. Graham was her love of her life.
Very disorientated, off-the-wall sort of character.
He was a bad boy, you know, and he liked the money that she was attracting too.
I mean, there were a number of times when Charlene and her partner would come in here carrying guns, and really, you know, my staff felt that it was beyond the call of their duty to look after people who would walk around with loaded guns and knives.
Charlene's and Graham's relationship was nothing if not fiery. In late 1991, Charlene went to visit Graham in hospital, and that's when things really went bad.
Fact sheet, general. Defendant, Charlene Spiteri.
According to the police report, Charlene and Graham had started drinking in the ward. An argument broke out over money.
The defendant then began to throw biscuits, magazines and other missiles about. When spoken to by police, the defendant said, "My name is Charlene, I've got AIDS. That cunt took my money, I want it back." Sister Lewis then said to the defendant, "Leave the hospital now." The defendant said, "I'm not fucking going anywhere."
When the police tried to take Charlene away, she showed them an open cut on her arm and lunged at one of the constables. Charlene was headed for the headlines once again.
AIDS whore charged. AIDS-carrying prostitute Charlene Spiteri appeared in Central Court yesterday, charged with assaulting and attempting to cause a policeman to contract AIDS. Sun Herald, 31st of March, 1991.
Charlene was assessed by the Probation and Parole Service. Her probation officer's report, which was tendered in evidence at her trial, was sympathetic in tone.
The offender is the eldest of eight children affected by many years of drug abuse, prostitution and the early legacy of a disturbed childhood, including the infliction of violence by her father upon her mother.
Charlene got 3 months in Mullawa Women's Prison without parole. While she was there, she met an old friend, Sam.
And even in jail, they wanted to put her in segregation, you know, in a cell by herself 24/7, you know, see no one, but the girls wouldn't accept it, no.
While Charlene was in jail, her boyfriend Graham died of a heroin overdose. Charlene was devastated.
He was her world, you know, like, and they wouldn't even let her go to the funeral, you know. And I think she was just angry because she never got to say goodbye to Graham, and that really, really, really stuck with her. That was the most painful thing she's ever had to deal with.
When Charlene got out of jail, there was a new home waiting for her, Badlands.
A group house under looser supervision of chaotic drug users with HIV who, because they were had been homeless, penniless, you know, aren't necessarily in control of their behaviour. I mean, until that time, you might get people having sex with someone simply so that they could get a bed for the night.
Badlands was a daring experiment in harm minimisation, the first of its kind in Australia. People there could continue to use drugs as long as it was off the premises. Badlands was set up specifically to house Charlene, but it sheltered dozens of chaotic drug users for more than a decade. We've uncovered some fascinating documents, day-to-day records of life inside Badlands. They've been untouched by journalists and historians up until now. What they reveal would have been politically explosive at the time. Statistical records, for example, show that many of Badlands clients had exactly the same risk behaviours as Charlene. They were HIV positive, using drugs, doing sex work, and having unprotected sex. There's no evidence that any of these individuals infected anyone with HIV. The harm minimisation strategy was working. But unlike Charlene, these chaotic drug users stayed under the radar.
Nice people from the agency, doesn't matter which one, they're all
all the same, the people and the agencies, designed to keep the problem stable. A quota of runaways, homeless, destitute, derelict and all stable today.
Charlene could easily have been a character in Darlinghurst Confidential, the celibate rifle's portrait of the inner city heroin scene. In the early 90s, Charlene went back and forth between Badlands and public housing in the inner city. During this time, the Very Naughty Persons Committee kept a watchful eye on her. The committee has a clear brief. If they think Charlene might go back to sex work, they can try counselling, warning letters and behavioural therapy, a whole range of measures. Detention, only a last resort. The approach works. And the health department tries something new. They move her to a cosy brick bungalow in suburban Canada Bay. Charlene loves the place. It's the closest thing to home she's had in many years. She has a team of live-in carers with her, and one of them is Mark Johnson.
She was somebody that who was very sentimental. She liked fluffy things. She liked toys. She's very childlike in a lot of ways. The behaviours, they were always grand-scale tantrums of a child. She was actually, when you got to know her, and if she liked you, she was actually a very warm person. Exhausting, but very warm.
Nadine Ballantyne saw the ad for the carer's position in the local newspaper.
I was told that my job would be to protect society from Charlene, basically. And when I first met her, she seemed fine. I was quite surprised that society needed protecting because she seemed quite not really capable of doing much damage, I suppose, at that stage, because she was so on the nod. She was on quite high dose of, or a reasonable high dose of methadone.
Charlene was leading the quiet life. She wasn't in prison, but neither was she a free woman. So as far as you were aware, was she under a public health order that whole time?
Yes, she was. Yes.
Did you ever see the order?
Each time it was to be renewed, we saw the order. There were stipulations about behaviour, about what not to do, and there was a consent to be signed at the bottom of the form. But it was about no sex work, period.
Like Mark, all of Charlene's carers are clear on this point. Charlene was under an order while they were looking after her at Canada Bay. But the New South Wales Health Department says that no such order existed. We applied to the Department of Health under Freedom of Information to get access to all the public health orders made against Charlene. The department gave us two sets of public health orders, the first dating from 1989 and the second from 2001. In between, there's a chasm of 12 years. So what was the order that Charlene had to sign every year? Tom Morton spoke to the current Chief Health Officer, Dr. Kerry Chant.
So can you confirm then that Charlene wasn't under a public health order in the period from late 1989 to 2001 when the other public health orders that we've obtained under FOI begin?
We've provided all the relevant public health orders. So there would have been a period where we had worked with Charlene and suggested a number of management strategies for Charlene, and they would have been offered to her, and her acceptance of those would have given us an assurance that we'd achieve that balance between risk to the community and her individual needs.
As you heard, Dr. Chant does not comment on whether or not Charlene was under an order. She says only that there were management strategies in place. In a separate email, the department told us,
intensive supervision outside the framework of a public health order is provided with the consent of the client concerned. Providing more detail would involve release of personal health information of Ms. Spiteri, and release could be contrary to new privacy laws.
But why does it matter what kind of order Charlene was under? Well, Charlene seems to have spent her time at Canada Bay in a kind of legal limbo. New South Wales Health's own guidelines for managing Charlene, the same ones framed by the former head of the AIDS Bureau, Ruth Cotton, had very strict rules about legal scrutiny. Any restrictions on a person's living circumstances, activities and employment had to be made under a court order, and that order had to be subject to review and appeal. But it appears that, while Charlene was living at Canada Bay, no such court order existed, nor was there any independent review or scrutiny of her situation, and that would be crucial in what followed. In her suburban detention in Canada Bay, Charlene was cut off from her friends and regular haunts. Estranged from her mother, her boyfriend dead, unable to have contact with her son, Charlene's father was her only regular visitor.
Everything that Charlene did, she would consult her father first. And he had complete control over her. If he wasn't happy with her behaviour, or they would have an argument, he would withdraw his company from her, which for her was agony.
He'd come around and visit her occasionally when you were caring for her?
He did initially, but he was a little bit inappropriate with female workers. Yeah, he wasn't allowed to be near us. On the times when Charlene wanted to visit her father, we would take her to her father's house, leave her there, and then pick her up at a prearranged time.
Charlene started to run short of money. She had enough for cigarettes, the trinkets and hair products that she was fond of. Her rent was paid, but it didn't seem to be enough.
She gave a lot to her dad. A lot of her money went to her dad. She would just hand it to him without spending stuff on herself. She would go without to give him money. And then I guess she fell into the pattern of then having to do what she do best, sex work, to get a bit more money, often to give to her dad.
But hold on a minute. How could Charlene do sex work if she was watched round the clock? Well, she wasn't the only one who was short of money. New South Wales Health had decided that at $150,000 a year, keeping Charlene under 24-hour supervision was too expensive. It began to withdraw funding. Charlene began to spend nights alone, or perhaps not. How do you know she was sex working if you weren't there?
She would tell us afterwards. Or we would ask her and she would deny it, then admit it, or she would have a mysterious amount of money in her handbag. When you're with her sort of on a day-to-day basis, you know that she spent her last $20 on a CD and then all of a sudden she's got 50.
So as staff, it was your job to prevent her from doing things like this. How did you handle it?
All we could do was report. It got to a point that the four staff there were going to go on strike because the situation had become so ridiculous that you'd walk into a situation of a sex-working premises. Nothing would be done. I mean, complaints would be made up the channel, but nothing would happen.
Let's be clear. No one actually saw Charlene doing sex work. The only evidence we have is what she told her carers. But they were sufficiently concerned to pass these reports on to their managers. One of those managers was Ross Johnston. Ross wasn't directly involved in managing Charlene's care at Canada Bay. That was done through an outreach service of Foley House, previously called Badlands. But Ross administered the funding for that service, so if there were critical incidents concerning Charlene, they were reported to him. Ross says the situation at Canada Bay was a powder keg waiting to blow.
It was reported to me that Charlene's father was in fact her pimp, and he took exception to the staff seeking to stop Charlene from working as a prostitute.
So these reports came to you from?
From the management of Foley House.
So in other words, they were clearly aware that there were concerns being raised by the staff.
Yes.
Was it your understanding that those concerns were referred upwards to New South Wales Health?
Yes, we referred them on to New South Wales Health, given their keen interest in the running of that service.
As you heard, Ross Johnston received reports of allegations concerning Charlene's father and passed those reports on to senior management at New South Wales Health. The ABC does not have any direct evidence of those allegations, and Mr. Spiteri denies them emphatically. Tom Morton spoke to Mr. Spiteri.
I met Mr. Spiteri at a cafe. At the start of our conversation, he made it plain that he wouldn't agree to be interviewed unless he was paid. I told Mr. Spiteri that a number of people we'd interviewed said that Charlene had been doing sex work at Canada Bay. I don't know what she did at night, he said. I only saw her during the day. I said that the same people had told us that he, her father, had encouraged her to do sex work for money. Mr. Spiteri replied, "That's all lies. I warned her not to do it." I invited Mr. Spiteri to repeat those denials in an interview. But again, Mr. Spiteri said he wouldn't be interviewed unless he was paid.
The situation at Canada Bay escalated. Charlene's carers were at their wits' end.
Things only really came to a head when the neighbours at Canada Bay threatened to have a meeting, a public meeting, with the media invited. And then things changed radically.
Once again, the media intervened.
Or the threat of.
The threat of media.
Yeah, the threat of the media. It was more to do with a threat of public disclosure. All those months preceding this, when there had been reports written, health warnings given, nothing happening, it changed very radically.
The health department now took firm action. In September 2001, it applied to the Administrative Decisions Tribunal for a new public health order to forcibly detain Charlene at Foley House. Now, it should be said that there was public scrutiny of this decision by the tribunal, but it's arguable that this scrutiny came too late. For Charlene, there was no going back. Her final 4 years under house arrest had begun.
Hey, if you're moving too fast, don't you want this thing to last?
Charlene never went anywhere alone. Never. Anywhere. It was a locked, a secure residence. It had a grill on the door and the workers had to let you out. That was one of the times that I would see her leave the house, is when she was taken to get her methadone.
It's nobody's business but my own. It's nobody's business but my own.
Other residents were like Charlene in terms of their lifestyle and their...
Other sex workers?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Who were HIV positive.
Yes.
But Charlene was there under different conditions.
Yes.
And she was in there for forever.
That was it. It seemed, yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought she was dead, and years before, until, you know, because no one had heard about her or seen her or anything, until I walked into Foley House to stay for a couple of weeks, and here she was, large as life. I nearly fell over backwards, you know. I thought, wow, what's going on, you know? Like, you're not dead yet, mate, you know? Like, yeah, she was still kicking and being obnoxious.
When you looked at her life in there then, what did you think?
Thank God it ain't me.
Towards the end of her life, her liver and kidneys started shutting down, and so she retained fluid, and so she was very large, you know. Because I remember saying to them at Foley House, to the manager there, why do you bother? She's not well enough, you know. By that stage, her legs had swollen. She's not going anywhere. And I went, yes, well, last time we let her off the order, she went up and worked. I went, oh, I don't think she's going anywhere this time, you know. She's not well enough.
In her last few months, Charlene's world shrank to a walled backyard in Surrey Hills. Her health went downhill fast. She'd lived on for nearly 20 years since she was first diagnosed with AIDS. Before she died, she was moved to a hospice. The public health order was taped to the wall above her bed.
She looked at me and she said, oh, I'm going to die. She knew. And she grieved about what was happening to her. She grieved about not being able to see her son. She wanted to see her son before she died.
She was a sex worker. She was a drug user. Why should anyone care about what happened to her?
She was still a human being that somewhere got lost along the way. And she disappeared below the radar.
She's a sick person, she needs help. That's the fundamental of the health system, to look after those that need it. She just declined the offers that were made to her. She'd make her own decisions. She was a free spirit, if you like, which made the system seek to try and cope with that free spirit. How well is unclear.
Shutting Down Charlene was written and produced by Eurydice Aroney and Tom Morton.
Research was by Justine Greenwood, and the sound engineer was Timothy Nicastri. And head to the Hindsight webpage for more information and references about this story. I'm Michelle Rayner. Look forward to your company on Hindsight next week. And stay with ABC Radio National after the 3 o'clock news for contemporary Australian drama in airplay. Today, Joshua's Books by Verity Lawton. Human stories, played out in Jericho across the ages, are transformed in their retelling. That's Airplay next, here on ABC Radio National.